From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Russia's defense ministry said its air force hit 12 Islamic State targets in a fresh wave of strikes in Syria. Syria's state television reported that Russian jets hit militant positions in the ancient city of Palmyra and the northern province of Aleppo. Those reports say the strikes destroyed ISIL vehicles and weapons depots in the area. The air raids in Aleppo reportedly hit two towns near a military airport that's currently besieged by ISIL fighters. According to the London-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, the Palmyra strikes killed 15 militants. CCTV's Alaa Ibrahim filed this report from Damascus.
The Russian Ministry of Defense in its statement said that a dozen ISIL targets were destroyed and some 20 sorties today. The main targets today were in Deir ez-Zor province to the east of the country. The province of Deir ez-Zor and the city of Deir ez-Zor has been under an effective ISIL siege for months now, and it was reportedly hit today by a series of car bombs aiming to take the city by ISIL. Alaa Ibrahim, CCTV, Damascus.
Meanwhile, more allegations from NATO that Russian aircraft violated Turkish airspace. NATO's chief, Jens Stoltenberg, spoke after an emergency meeting of the organization's top brass Tuesday.
I will not speculate on the motives. I will just reiterate or restate that this is a serious violation of Turkish airspace. It should not happen again. The airspace of Turkey, which also is NATO airspace.
Moscow said the first incursion was an error and that the second was under investigation. The emergency NATO meeting comes as its leaders were already assembling for a meeting Thursday to discuss the doubling of its shock troop force to 40,000 and the opening of a number of new bases in Central and Eastern Europe. The reports came Tuesday as Russian airstrikes in Syria entered their fifth day. The U.S. and Europe claimed that Russia was only hitting targets belonging to opposition groups against the Syrian government. In response, the Russian Foreign Ministry presented maps and images of ISIS command centers, tanks, and fueling lines that had been hit by its fighter planes. CCTV's Tian Wei spoke with former Kremlin advisor Alexander Nekrasov in London, Professor Raymond Tanter from the University of Michigan in Washington, D.C., and Josef Janning from the European Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin about Washington's accusations against Moscow.
Mr. Nekrasov, we understand Russia said that this is a mistaken crossing. However, NATO condemned it, and also U.S. said it's working with the Turkish allies on the possible solutions. What do you think this would mean for the next stage of Russia's involvement on the issue of Syria?
Well, I think, first of all, we must accept that the response from the West and some of the allies of the West in the Middle East to the Russian involvement was not, to be honest, a fair, a proper response. Because, as President Putin himself pointed out, and the military in Moscow as well, that accusations that Russia was bombing moderate opposition and even civilians started to fly even before the planes took off. The Russian planes. So it is obvious that the West is trying to use this whole issue as a propaganda war, having itself, by the way, failed to achieve any significant results in battling ISIS. Now, It has been made pretty clear that the main enemy at the moment is ISIS. And Russia has pointed out that it is going to go after them, and some serious successes have been already achieved. There are also other groups that are violent and terrorist groups that are fighting alongside ISIS, but for some reason they have suddenly become moderate rebels.
Even though
we know perfectly well that these so-called moderate rebels commit crimes, fight along ISIS, fight along with Al-Qaeda, and have been committing terrible, terrible atrocities against the civilians.
I got your point. Let me go to Professor Tanter from the U.S. to respond to what you have just said. Professor Tanter, first of all, the so-called mistake crossing by the Russian side, and secondly, has the United States, together with NATO, for example, been picking bones out of the soup, trying to make a small thing a big fuss so that to prevent Russia from further fight against ISIS in Syria?
Tinguay, number one, the United States and Turkey are putting up a no-go zone in order to protect the Christians and other minorities along the border between Turkey and Syria. And the idea that there's an accidental Russian crossing of a border is just patent nonsense. Russia has very good air support. There are people on the ground in terms of the radars. And as a result, Turkey and the United States are coming much closer. And the F-22s are being given to Israel in order to make sure that Israel has the wherewithal to counter the Russian SA-4 in Syria. And Russia is not targeting the moderates, is not targeting ISIL. It's having the Iranian proxies from Iraq to come in to do the dirty work against ISIS. Russia is targeting with barrel bombs those Free Syrian Army forces that it says it wants to talk to. This is propaganda. All right. It's nonsense. And Russia is not going to repeat the kind of propaganda warfare that it had in World War II.
I see. Mr. Yanin.
The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
You certainly have just heard rhetoric coming from both sides. Of course, the European countries are coming in also with certain sides. Having said that, though, what do you make of the debates now going on that Russia has been, at least coming from Russian press, making its precision bombs against, using its precision bombs rather, against ISIS? Well, they argue that the Americans are bombing the hospitals in Afghanistan, as being claimed by Medecins Sans Frontières.
Well, yes, there's a lot of political rhetoric and a lot of sidetracking also going on there. From a European perspective, presence now of Russia, which initially seemed to offer the possibility of a return to a Geneva Accord type of a cooperation among the permanent five members of the Security Council, now see that there's a lot of conflict going on. There is no coordination, there is mutual acquisition, and there is no combined strategy. So there is actually no strategy on both sides how to lay out a strategy together if it requires boots on the grounds to successfully combat ISIS in Syria.
I see. Let me come back to you, Professor Tander, because your president, President Barack Obama, during his public speech at the UN Security Council earlier, said very clearly, here I quote, U.S., quote, is ready to work with any nation, including Russia and Iran, on the issue of Syria. So what kind of attitude has Washington shown so far in order to reflect that statement coming from your president?
The United States has softened its position, and it's in line with the European position with respect to making sure that there's a political transition after the end of which would have Assad to leave. In other words, both President Obama and Secretary Kerry have not taken a position independently of the European nations. So I think that our colleague in Berlin, who said there's a lot of political rhetoric between Russia and the United States on this, that's simply not true. The United States and Europe are together.
Mm. But what about working with Russia? From your president, he said, and I quoted earlier, so has the United States done anything specific in that direction? Or willing to do anything specific in that direction? Go ahead, sir.
The United States Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, is working with his counterpart in Russia in order to make sure that Russian and American aircraft do not attack each other accidentally. The United Israel is making sure that its bombing raids of Hezbollah in Iranian support of Hezbollah in Syria do not accidentally go up against Russian aircraft. So there's a tremendous amount of what is called deconflicting going on, making sure that the two sides, the three sides, do not go head to head with each other accidentally.
Deconflicting, but what about the ultimate strategy, Mr. Nikrasov? Have countries, in fact, conflicting one another in their strategies of dealing with Syria? After all sides have different opinions about whether Assad has to go or not and the timetable for it.
Well, that's the whole problem. You see, it has been Russia has pointed out from the first day of its bomb strikes that Assad needs to stay because the Syrian army is the only force that is still fighting ISIS and other terrorist groups. Now, immediately, the moment Russia said that, the Western countries and some of the regional countries started saying that Russia wants to keep Assad forever. Now, the point was that before any political or diplomatic dialogue could take place, ISIS needs to be taken out. There's no point in trying to launch any initiative in Syria and find a solution, diplomatic solution, until these monsters are destroyed. But it is practically impossible to do that because we hear every day, practically every day, coming from Washington, Paris, London, Berlin, and so on, how bad Assad is. And that has to stop. There has to be a period of time when all of the forces involved will deal with the enemy, with the biggest enemy, not Assad. Assad is not the biggest enemy. ISIS is the biggest enemy.
But let me ask you, Mr.
Nikrasov.
And
once they deal with that, then they can start talking, but not before.
Mr. Nikrasov, may I just follow up a bit? Because your government, including your parliament members dealing with the armed forces, have been talking about Russia is likely to send those quote-unquote volunteers coming from East Ukraine going into the battlefields of Syria, even though Russia itself has decided not to send any ground troops. But is that decision or is that reflection of a decision necessarily going to more complicate the current situation, Mr. Nikrasov?
Well, first of all, President Putin and the Russian military have already said they're not going to send any Russian ground troops to Syria. That has been pointed out several times. There have been statements made by all sorts of people, including the president of the Chechen Republic and other people, that they are, sort of itching to go and fight on the ground in Syria against ISIS. I don't think we should take these statements too seriously. I don't think anybody, not just the Russians, but the Americans and the others, want to get involved on the ground in Syria, because that will be a completely different level of involvement. I think we are going to see a bombing campaign for several months. I don't know the exact day, probably nobody, no, sorry, length, nobody knows for sure, because it depends on success on the grounds. But already we are seeing that ISIS are retreating, so that there are good signs on the ground.
Really, ISIS are retreating? Mr. Yanning, we heard about the story ISIS destroying another gigantic historic world cultural heritage site inside Syria. We have also heard from your counterparts inside France that they began bombing the ISIS. The Americans say we're also taking actions of various sorts. Is this kind of competition between the U.S. and Russia really likely to help with the situation? Or actually, the both sides just try to claim their own territory? Nothing likely to solve the problem. Mr. Yanning.
Well, it's very complicated indeed. I don't see ISIS fully retreating. There is a lot of tactical retreat and repositioning going on due to the firepower from above. But I think what's important now is that we start building some common ground between the international powers. I think there is agreement on the issue of keeping the integrity of a country like Syria because of the significant spillover effect a disintegrating Syria would have, also in terms of the consolidation of ISIS there. And secondly, there is agreement on taking ISIS out of the equation as one of the starting points to go back to a more political process. And for that, that, I believe, currently all sides know that they need players on the ground to do the job that cannot be done alone by airstrikes from above. And that's the question then, how one assesses the situation. Is there enough boots available on the part of the Kurdish forces, on the part of the Syrian opposition? Probably not. And then you need some of the boots that Assad controls, and maybe also some of the boots that the Iranians are financing. And that, I believe, is the tricky part of a political understanding between Americans, Europeans, and Russians in this.
For more on this and the larger geopolitical context, we spoke with analyst Sukant Chandan in London. We spoke with him via Skype Wednesday. We've got the Russians conducting air raids coordinate with the Syrian armed forces, and with that combination, an actual battle plan against ISIS and the other terrorist groups inside Syria. There's very little discussion about what the scene is on the ground there, who the terrorist groups are. Maybe we could talk about that some.
Yeah, sure, but just I think it's much grander and bigger than just the Russians helping the Syrian government at the latter's invitation. It's a historical game changer what we're seeing now. In late 2013, I think it was around September 2013, you remember Western nations wanted to go for a full-scale open war of aggression and destruction like they did in Libya. That was scuppered by the veto by China and Russia at the United Nations Security Council. So that was very important. That was for the first time in modern history that we've seen forces of the global south stop and push back an attempt, an open attempt at imperialist war. So that was very significant. And now what we've seen today, the last week or so, with Russia coming at the invitation of the Syrian government, upping its involvement in Syria, is what we've been, frankly, waiting for quite a few years now. We've been waiting for a united approach from our side to push back this whole imperialist death squad and war strategy. So it's something that's totally changed the attempts of the Western nations to de facto partition Syria and then in order to destroy it. We're pushing that back, and you know, I hope all the best to them. And to answer your question directly about the armed gangs of death squads on the ground, I think the Foreign Minister Lavrov was absolutely right. You know, at the end of the day, if gangs are taking up weapons in order to overthrow a legitimate and sovereign, and I would say argue a quite a decent government in the Syrian Arab Republic, well, they're terrorists. And but obviously Putin and Lavrov and the Russian leadership have sent a very clear and definitive message, particularly to the United States, France, and Britain, that your so-called Free Syrian Army are game. And it's rattled profoundly, especially the Brits and the Yanks. And they don't know what to do because they haven't got the guts and the capacity to have a direct confrontation with Russia. And that's a really important lesson for people who believe in peace around the world and anti-imperialists to understand that actually if our side can have a united approach, even a few countries and a handful of countries, we can push back the imperialists. And they haven't got the stomach to face us off. We've been seeing this ever since the late 90s, early 2000s, but we kind of faltered slightly during the Arab Sting, 2011, 2012, and we're back on that momentum.
You know, there has been some considerable discussion in the media about the Iraqi government also perhaps welcoming the Russians into fighting ISIS within Iraq as well. And, of course, Russia is standing on the legitimacy of its involvement in Syria because it was invited by the government, which under international law is all you need in the absence of a UN Security Council resolution, which the United States, by the way, does not have as it operates in Syria.
That's right.
If Iraq were to ask, you know, invite Russia to help there, you know, I'm looking beyond that, using this model in Syria, to perhaps say the newly recognized government of Palestine asking for Russian help. What do you think of the prospects of wider Russian involvement in the Middle East generally?
Well, I think we have to go step by step, and you know, things are slowly you know, kind of functioning and kind of being placed into place by our side. It's not going to happen overnight. It never happens overnight. It's an incremental developmental process. So, first of all, the Russians and the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Syrian government have a coordinating office in Baghdad. That's open. That's in the mainstream. They've openly stated that. That's a brilliant, really important historical development. Now, the Russians are close to many other countries in the region, and also they're also close to, you know, they at least are in conversation with many of what I would consider the alliance of our imperialist enemies in the region. So I'm talking about the Gulf monarchies, talking about the whites at the state of so-called Israel. And what I wouldn't consider in the alliance of enemies is also the Russians are close to Egypt, which is a very important player in this whole mosaic of the situation. So we've got a coordination by four countries, that's Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Russia. There's noises, there's no confirmation that the Chinese want to get involved. I'm watching RT Russia Today, and they say there's reports that Chinese want to join the Russians. I'm not sure about that. It'll be interesting that that's the case, but I'm not sure that is the case, actually. So in terms of what you're saying about recognition of the Palestinian state, etc., actually, the Russians suggested that the Palestinian Authority have attack helicopters and tanks less than a decade ago. So you know, they're quite strident to make bold moves. At the same time, Russia has an interesting, relatively close relationship to the white settler colonial state as well, for a number of different reasons. But although that's controversial, perhaps, to some, I actually think that's an advantage on our side, because the white colonial settler state has bombed Syria about 5-6 times in the last 4-5 years. And it's important that the Russians ensure that the white colonial settler state stays the hell out while Russia is helping the Syrian government clean up. It's very important that we don't have a kind of a tangential conflagration that we just don't need at the moment. So I think the Russians are playing it very cleverly and very correctly. But in terms of where we ideally want to get to, we have to just go through the contradictions. We have to go through the difficulty of reality. And, you know, there's an incredible historical advances. We need to celebrate that, promote that, protect that, make people understand what this is all about in the most positive light in terms of the united strategy that we have. And we will definitely see further victories.
You know, I'm wondering if we're maybe seeing, in some ways, a reset back to maybe around 1960, when pan-Arabism was manifesting itself in a state that was to ultimately encompass Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. That was broken up, and then Nasser died, and the United States got involved, and the whole Salafist you know, phenomenon nurtured and weaponized. But now we're looking at, you have al-Sisi in Egypt, who has been friendly with the Russians and comes in, of course, in opposition to the Muslim Brotherhood. You have the situation that's developing in Syria and the situation that's developing in Iraq again. Could we be maybe looking at a resurgence of indigenous pan-Arabism protected perhaps by Russian air cover and political involvement?
I think there's some truth in what you're saying. I think generally history never repeats itself exactly the same twice or thrice. But yes, there's some truth in what you're saying. Yes, there's definitely, you know, with Iraq and Syria having a strategic unity, which has been the case anyway, because the Baghdad government is basically part of the resistance axis. That aside from the quite profound and traumatic contradictions within Iraq and the whys and therefores, which is a connected but separate critical conversation that needs to be had. Perhaps is not the primary conversation to be had right now. But in terms of the differences between now and the 60s, there are many, there are several, but two that come to mind most prominently. One is still we have an absence of the kind of combative, assertive leadership that we saw under Gamal Abdel Nasser and the other forces in the region. Sisi is no Nasser. Sisi is someone who's protecting the Egyptian body politic and the Egyptian army under attack by the Muslim Brotherhood and allied supremacist death squad forces supported by the West. He just wants to maintain the viability and the cohesion of Egypt, which is fair enough, but that doesn't necessarily translate into Nasserism. But that being said, in a global context whereby imperialism wants to destroy you, it doesn't want to. It hasn't got the capacity or the interest to prop up dictators like it did in previously. So it wants to destroy any obstacle to its attempted monopolization of power across the world. So people like Sisi, they have no other option but to ally closer and closer with Russia. I mean, Egypt, even under Mubarak, had increasingly close relationship with China, which perhaps is one of the reasons the West felt that it needed to drop Mubarak back in 2010. But that aside for a second. So, you know, there's no real alternative for forces of the global south but to hug closer the bear and the dragon, Russia and China. And Russia and China are part of the BRICS, and the BRICS is part of a wider global alliance. So we're getting there. We're getting there slowly. We're not quite there yet. There needs to be a shift in Egypt, and I think Egypt needs to fully de-link itself to its financial dependency, which then brings some semblance of political dependency to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is a primary global ally of the British and the USA. Now, Egypt receives about $10 billion a year. I think it's a lot more than that, sorry, annually from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. That's got to be replaced by other assertive global south forces, particularly Russia and China. So we have to get to that point. But, and this is the final point I'll make on Egypt, Sisi and Egypt have openly supported the Russian pushback against the death squads at the invitation and partnership of the Syrian government. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia have opposed it. And actually, I've said there should be a so-called, you know, the misinterpretation and perversion of jihad against the Russians. So although Sisi is somewhat beholden to the KSA, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, at the same time, he's obviously politically looking to reorient himself in the counter-opposition strategy towards the Gulf monarchies and particularly Saudi Arabia. So many things are in flux. Many things are in process. We've got to weed out all the positive developments and all of this and try to advocate and push forward outside the best we can.
Sukhan Shandin, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, brother.
This report from Ukraine, where some 16,000 Ukrainian soldiers have defected from the zone of military operations in the conflict-ridden eastern provinces of Donbas, many carrying weapons, that, according to the country's chief military prosecutor, Anatoly Matyos, speaking with reporters Monday. That news followed a report by Colonel Alexander Pravdivets, senior deputy of Ukraine's Armed Forces Mobilization Department, that during the recent sixth wave of conscription, almost 27,000 draftees, about 50,000 of the total, had dodged military service. The U.S. Justice Department is preparing to release roughly 6,000 inmates from federal prisons starting at the end of this month. That's part of an effort to ease overcrowding and roll back the harsh penalties given to nonviolent drug offenders in the 1980s and 90s. This according to reports in the media today, including in the New York Times and Washington Post. About one-third of the inmates are reportedly undocumented immigrants who will be deported. The release will be one of the largest discharges of inmates from federal prisons in American history, according to the Times. It coincides with an intensifying bipartisan effort to ease the mass incarceration that followed decades of tough sentencing for drug offenses, which have taken a particularly harsh toll on so-called minority communities. RT's Igor Pyeskinov has more.
It's going to be the biggest one-time release of federal prisoners in U.S. history. And there are two main reasons behind that. One is the authorities want to ease the pressure on federal prisons, which are overcrowded right now. And the second one is that this is one of the effects that we're seeing of the government softening its policies towards drug-related crimes. Because about a year ago, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, it's an independent body which actually sets the sentencing policies, they decided to start softening the punishments for various drug-related crimes. Authorities say that altogether we could be seeing about 46,000 inmates which could potentially be freed as part of this whole policy. And that is about one half of all the drug offenders currently serving time in federal prisons.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.